Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
We dropped our bombs near Munich and turned off the target back for England. As deep as I could see into Germany, the sky was stained with smoke from the targets, scattered around, smashed and missing and burning. We were going home. Home is when the props stop spinning. I looked around, very tired. From up there it all looked so green and beautiful, and what we had done so sort of horrible. We got our first look at fighters on that Munich hull. There were ring around the roses on all sides for part of the time. "Hell of a scramble out at 9 o'clock, Krohn called up. We couldn't tell 109s from P-51s or Fokker Wolfs. We couldn't tell which side was winning or what kind went down. They looked like they were playing around, and then one broke off in a dive that ended when it hit the ground. Jesus, Sharp said. Did you see that? The explosion died away to a bloody glow. Somebody was dead down there. All the way in from the Rhine, it was like that. And that, in that immaculate American accent...
I mean,
accent,
honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, I was transported there.
Yeah. So where was I? Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but considered an educated man, though.
Yes, which, of course, Bert Stiles was. That is from Serenade to the Big Bird, which, for my money, is the ultimate in bomber memoirs. It's just so good. And I first read it when I was doing my Normandy book and reread it for this, and it's just fantastic. And I thought actually we'd have a little bit of a look at Bert Stiles and what he was up to during the course of this.
And that you say Normandy, that you looked at this for your Normandy book, not for your Big Week book, I think points us in the direction that this episode is is very much
very
headed.
Neatly.
Because in a way, we've reached the stage of the 8th Air Force's campaign where Overlord is magnetic north now. All roads lead to Normandy.
Yep.
And I think what we've outlined in the last few episodes is that there's been this bomber force created sort of really with on the back of an envelope with some wishful thinking and a blank check, and that it's developed into the 8th Air Force in fits and starts, and finally the taps are on for replacing whatever's lost attrition wise, which is really the key. And the numbers as we go through 1944 at Mitchell's disposal are absolutely incredible. Beggar belief to only a year before, 9 months before, 6 months before. The scale of the power of the weapon he has at his disposal as the year unfolds is truly amazing. They've tried precision bombing. They've come up against the weather. They've come up against the Luftwaffe, which actually turns out to be sort of hollow, really, once put to the test. They've cracked the problem of fighter escort, not just that you need one, but what it has to do, that it has to free range, and its priority has to be the destruction of the Luftwaffe fighter arm rather than even the protection of the bomber force. That protection of the bomber, how you protect the bomber forces by destroying the Luftwaffe, not by simply protecting the bomber force. So there's been this, all of these elements coming into play. And now, just as the weapon is perfected, sorry, Overlord, sorry, boys, whatever ambition you're pursuing or whatever ambition Bomber Commander pursuing, it's all on hold for the invasion of Europe, Northwest Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes and no.
But this is the interesting thing, isn't it? It's because that's like the point blank directive after Casablanca, which appears to lay out actually the way things have got to go. There is quite a lot of
wiggle room
for interpretation. And also, and you know, we are talking about the 8th Air Force here, but it's no surprise that the man running Bomber Command is also extremely headstrong, believes in what he's doing, yes, won't take no for an answer, and also will interpret his orders as loosely as possible in order to get what he wants.
But actually, so to his spots is cut from exactly the same cloth. He's also as kind of ideological and determined to kind of pursue his own way, you know. Well, we'll come on to that in a minute. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I wrote Big Week all those years ago because I felt that this was an absolute tipping point and really the kind of crux of the strategic bombing campaign. This is the moment where everything changes, I think. And it's interesting going back over this material and looking at this period again. Actually, nothing's made, you know, my mind hasn't been changed at all. I mean, I still stand by that. And I think you can see it even more so now that you're kind of progressing on to kind of looking at the strategic air forces following Big Week. You can see that even more. And some interesting things are going on in kind of February and March before we get to the kind of Overlord prep proper. That's really worth going into. And actually, that tipping point is A, because, as you say, they know what they need to do now. B, because they finally cracked the long-range fighter issue. But C, because the scale is now suddenly
But
this on a different level.
But this is I think more than anything else, this is...
And scale, sorry, just one thing, is that scale means that you've got 1,000 bombers nigh on every single time you go on a raid and similar number of fighter planes to call upon. Well, they got more like 500 at this point, half of it. But what that means is you can now smother.
Yeah, you can overwhelm.
So you can, your main target can be Oschersleben or Leipzig or whatever, but you can also do 6 subsidiary targets.
And it's always interesting in this is that
there's not enough attention on that, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, the Luftwaffe is often in the documents. It's always called the GAF, isn't it? The German Air Force, which I always slightly get pulled up by.
Yes,
but the German Air Force. The Luftwaffe doesn't know which way to turn.
Yep.
And whichever way it turns will be answered with aggressive, pretty much will be answered with aggressive fighter action. So they're being brought to the fight and it's a fight they can't win. Like you say, though, the numbers here, German fighter production is also now trying to go flat out to meet the problem.
But they can't solve that problem because there's two parts to a fighter plane.
Yeah.
There's the plane.
And there's the pilot.
And there's the pilot.
Yeah.
And you have as many planes as you like, but if you haven't got the pilots to fly them, you're stuffed.
Exactly. And that's the big
win on Big Week.
Yeah. And they're being hollowed out in terms of experience. The really crucial thing is the people 100%. Who can tell the new pilots how to fly.
Yep.
Who can tell them
the tricks of the trade.
Get up, get the sun behind you. Do all those things.
Have a look at the sun properly by turning your wing.
Yeah. They're just
Zemka style.
They're not available anymore.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you look at, because Bomber Commander also, I mean, it's basically 1,000, in theory, on a perfect day, it's 1,000 bombers during the day, 1,000 bombers at night, 500 fighter planes.
And it's getting up to kind of 1,000 fighter planes.
So the ability to hammer Germany and keep it reeling.
Well, I go back to 15th of September 1940. You know, the biggest raid of Battle of Britain Day is 100 German bombers.
Yeah, I know. I know. And you think of the flap and some of the mythology around that.
I mean, I remember I was looking up and the sky was black with swastikas, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you sort of think, try being over Leipzig.
But one of the
spring of 1944.
One of the interesting things about this, though, I think is the word strategic, isn't it? Because this is the strategic bomber offensive, after all. And in the bomber men's mind, that the idea is that you're operating independent of the rest of everything else.
Yeah.
And you are a strategy unto your strategy unto yourselves.
Yes.
And that you dictate that strategy and you are the strategy.
And if you want people to do stuff for the army, create a tactical air force.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
We should do the tactical stuff.
But what happens is beginning to happen is the strategists themselves are now leaning in and going, well, actually we need to co-opt your you for our strategy and use you for the even bigger strategy that isn't your strategy.
Yes.
And yes, you're a strategic air force, but we demand you being co-opted to what we want to do.
But even before Big Week, there is a new directive.
Yeah.
Which is issued on the 13th of February. And I love these new directives because they come thick and fast.
Yeah.
And they're always just a tweak.
Yeah.
So they're still full of the, you know, progressive destruction of, you know, the Nazi war machine, the German war machine.
Dislocation. Which is fantastically, like, whatever.
Yeah. But another one is issued. And there is a sort of slight feeling from the Americans that the Brits aren't quite putting their weights on point-blank targets.
Yeah.
Albeit they're definitely putting their weight big time. And that's a fair and legitimate point because they're not.
Yeah.
Because Harris is doing whatever he wants.
Yeah.
and on the 21st of January, General Marshall, who's the chief of the combined staff in the US, points out that only 20% of Bomber Command's bomb tonnage is expended on German fighter targets. I mean, actually, I think that's quite high for Bomber Command.
That's quite high for Bomber Command. And also, given...
And it's gone up by 15% points during Big Week.
Well, and given that the Americans are bombing blind because of the weather, I mean, I would not get too fussy about where your bombs are landing if for points of comparison, would you? Because bad weather bombing and radar-guided bombing or whatever euphemism the Americans are using for it, some of their bombing is butt report level of accuracy.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Yeah. But anyway, the latest directive is pretty much the same as the one of the previous year. The progressive destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial and economic systems, the disruption of vital elements of lines of communication and the material reduction of the German air combat strength by the successful prosecution of the combined bomber offensive from all convenient bases. So, okay. But the priority remains, the first priority, excuse me, is German single and twin engine fighter airframe and component production when was bracketed with the Axis controlled ball bearing production.
So still on about the ball bearings.
Still on about ball bearings. Second priority, installations supporting the German fighter force.
Yeah.
So airfields, whatever. Third priority, crossbow targets,
which are
starting to come in from November.
Yeah.
So crossbow targets are V1 and V2 sights.
Yeah.
And they're very difficult to hit because they're quite small and they're usually in a wood and they've got a sort of tiny little ramp, which is only about kind of 3 foot wide, if that. And so they're incredibly difficult to hit, but they're all being built in sort of Holland.
And that's coming from Schaeff, isn't it? That's coming from Eisenhower, isn't
absolutely.
it?
Absolutely. And particularly from the British leaning on the Americans because they know they're all pointing towards London.
Yeah. And they don't know what the V2 is even. There's considerable argument as to whether the V2 has a 10-ton warhead rather than a ton warhead. They just don't know.
No, they don't know.
And there's debate at cabinet level as to what if it's a 10-ton warhead, then we really have a problem.
Yep.
Because that the destructive power is the most destructive thing anyone has come up against.
Yeah, completely. It's a massive problem. Yeah. And they know about this from Peenemünde.
Yeah.
Which ironically they hit on the 17th of August.
Yeah.
Everything happens on the 17th of August. First face-to-face negotiations with the Italians to the armistice.
Yeah.
Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid.
Yeah.
And Peenemünde.
Yeah.
Anyway, so crossbow targets, that's what crossbow means, is those V1s and V2 sites. Berlin and other industrial areas, which I think is really interesting.
Well, I know it's interesting, Berlin and other industrial areas. I mean, Berlin isn't an industrial target.
It is a bit.
But not really.
I've been to the Heikel plant at Oranienburg.
Yeah, but what's it? But it's about striking the capital. I know there are industrial sites there, but it's about the fact that Göring has said there'll be no bombers over Berlin.
Of course, but isn't it interesting that after the Battle of the Ruhr, Harris launches the Battle of Berlin in the autumn of 1943, and it's perceived to be a failure.
Yeah. Yes. Well, because it is a failure.
It's not even perceived to be a failure. It is a failure. And yet this is on the list. And then the other one is targets in Southeast Europe and the Balkans, which I think is interesting.
Yes.
Mutually supporting attacks by strategic forces of US, of United States and Britain were to be pursued with relentless determination against the same target areas of systems so far as tactical conditions allow.
I mean, imagine being a crewman and reading that. Well, we've got to pursue this with relentless determination, have we? Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks.
What do you think we're doing?
Yes, exactly. I'll get my coat.
But basically, this is the same stuff. It's sort of carry on and here are the tweaks. And
well, I think the crossbow ones is quite interesting. They're difficult targets because they're so small, but actually they fit in very well into the CBO, the Combined Bomber Offensive, and also within the wider point blank plan, I think, because they're a hop and a skip across the channel.
Yeah.
They're inverted commas a milk run.
Yeah.
And you can do them on dodgy days when
Yes.
You know, when you're
easier
when
you're, to find and all that. Easier although to they're find, small, you know, the French coast is easy to find.
You know, say
in a way
a big
that Essen
of,
isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. Say there's a big bank of cloud over kind of sort of Southern Reich, then okay, well we'll just go and do some crossbows.
Yeah.
And you're still sort of ticking that box.
Yeah. And I mean everything's putting the Luftwaffe under strain. Everything.
Yeah.
If you have drawn the Luftwaffe fighter effort to the Reich, you can attack the point blank targets far more easily.
Yeah.
So whatever whichever lever, the main lever, which is to attack Germany itself, has been pulled, and that's drawn the Luftwaffe away, and then it's being attrited in Germany, so it can't defend these sites.
Yeah.
So it's sort of the swings and the roundabouts actually working in the Americans' favour in this instance.
Yeah, although the other problem they've got is that the 15th Air Force, which was seen as so vital for the reason for going into the Italian campaign in the first place, you know, the main reason was to get those airfields at Foggia.
Oh, it's killing
upgraded
me.
Upgraded from 6 bomb groups to 21 bomb groups by March 1944. Well, here we are at the beginning of March 1944, and temporarily, but still at a crucial moment in the air war, those bomb groups have been handed over to the ground forces, support the ground forces.
Yeah.
So this is sort of smashing of monasteries and bridges and, you know, hitting Turin and the Brenner Pass.
Well, attacks on bridges then feed into the thinking that pans out in Northwest Europe anyway.
Yeah.
What should you strike?
That's the thorny issue which we'll get onto.
Which
we'll but first
get,
of all, we should talk about
Berlin.
Berlin. and I think it's interesting because, we talked about my mate Larry Goldstein in Worrywart when we were doing Big Week.
Yeah.
Here he is. His 25th mission is Berlin for the first time. I mean, imagine you pulled that straw.
You'd think, oh, God, what have I got? What's a guy got to do around here?
Exactly. So his diary's really good. And, do you want to read this one?
Well, and they're going for ball bearings. But it's actually to draw German fighters into the sky. And it's also the symbolism of Berlin is so important and powerful. Just after bombs away, an enemy fighter hits us with a 20mm cannon boost, narrowly missing me in the radio room. Bomb bay doors refused to close, so had to be cranked up by hand. This was only half accomplished. Returned to field and upon landing found there were no brakes. BJ handled the ship like an expert, taking us off the runway, through a fence, and finally to a stop. Nobody hurt or even shaken up. Ship was well sprayed with holes from the one burst. Hole in radio room was awful close, but that was all. At last, I have walked away from the plane on my 25th mission unscathed. Thank God!
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
I mean, that whole day for him couldn't have gone worse until the moment that he actually gets out of the plane.
Jesus Christ.
First of all, you've got to get to Berlin.
Yeah.
Then you do get hit. Then you can't crank up get the undercarriage down.
Yeah.
Then the brakes have gone. Every single turn, you're thinking, this is my last moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
I mean, obviously, the fate's deciding to give him a pass there. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
He was such a laugh. He was such a good bloke.
Was he?
Yeah, he was a really good bloke.
Cool. Well, it's great that he's in this account. The thing is, though, they don't get to Berlin, do they?
Not really.
I mean,
only one of 14 combat
it's
wins.
It's a long way away. That's a long way to go.
Yep.
The weather's bad. There's 14 combat wings and only one of them gets there.
Yeah. It's not... Second one's a bit better.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
That's 2 days later, 6th of March.
Yeah. And they
and, going... and this, incidentally, is the first time that the 4 fighter group are in Mustangs.
Right.
Over, you know,
right.
on long range duties.
Right.
So Don Blakesley and co, they're all off and they're loving it.
And this is actually Gainshagen, which is south of Berlin, isn't it? So, you know, if you're Nazi government, you're looking up and thinking, oh, crap.
660 bombers, 400 bombers, that's a lot of bombers.
Yeah, yeah.
It sure beats your 100 twin engine over London.
And fighters. I mean, although, I mean, you say 600 bombers, 660 bombers, 69 aircraft loss, so 10% loss rate. Which
but it's not 20.
Yeah. Yes.
And suddenly the production line is churning at a rate that it wasn't.
Yeah.
In 1943.
And then on the 8th of March, a third raid with
this is absolutely amazing.
1,015 fighters in support.
It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
They only lose 17, but shoot down 87 enemy aircraft.
Yeah.
I mean, those are big hits.
And Goering, do you want to do Goering?
Yeah.
It's not Goering, is it? It's the American official history, but basically...
No, I'm going to say this. Should I do it in... I can't do it in... I wanted to do it in German.
The US official history is the sight of compact and oddly formations of American heavy bombers flying in clear sky over the city could not but have made a deep impression on the Berliners. We have Goering's word that the appearance of American long-range fighters over Berlin was even more disturbing to the military. So Goering,
Gott in Himmel!
Exactly.
Where are these fighters coming from?
He's got the Führer on the phone going, "You told me Berlin was safe!"
So you're still at the stage, aren't you, with Daisy, where you where you're reading her stories and stuff?
Yeah.
So I did that with my Daisy for quite a long time. And towards the end of that period of my life,
yeah,
she'd say, "Read it in German."
Really?
So I'd have to do the whole night of reading, really? You know.
Well, we are.
And then Danny went to the forest and started to lace the pheasants. It's really funny.
Danny's a champion of the world.
Yeah, Danny is the champion of the entire Welt. It's really funny.
Well, we're doing the Greek myths at the moment.
And then, really, well, yeah, yeah, because yeah. So, the other day she said, you used to read me, and she said, I never used to really listen. I just used to like kind of going to sleep with you kind of talking at me.
Yeah. They don't listen.
And so I'd say, and you remember last night, Danny was kind of in the woods and just driven with his wooden blocks.
So you could have sat there and given her tales of the Point Blank Offensive.
Well, I'm slightly feeling it's a missed opportunity. Anyway, back to
back to Berlin. I mean, this is interesting because this is only a month after Big Week, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
no, it's not even that. It's 10 days.
Yeah, yeah. So the sheer turnover in bomber crews and replacements.
It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
It's just those production lines.
Yeah.
They've got to kind of go, you know, they start slow and then they sort of, you know, it's like a train, like an old steam train pulling out of a station.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like...
Yeah, yeah. Once they built up the momentum, yeah,
yeah.
And it's $250,000 for a B-17, which
it's so much money, isn't
kind
it?
Of two point, which is sort of I think kind of 2.6 million now. So they're not. I mean, they're not
a lot cheaper than F-35.
Well, exactly. I was just going to say that they're a lot cheaper than F-35. But you know that is a lot of money because how many built? 26,000, something like that.
Yep.
Maybe someone in the booth could get a calculator out and work out what 26,000 times $250,000 is. But they're spending a lot of money just on the airframes,
just on bombers. Before you get to everything else,
before you get to everything else. But it's, yeah. So they cost $250,000 each. They make 26,000. So that's like. Apparently that's sort of $6.5 billion.
Okay.
Spent on airframes.
Yep. So that gets you, doesn't get you out of St Pancras, does it? No. On the HST. I think I'd rather the bombers.
I'd sooner fly to Manchester in a B-17.
So would
you could. I mean, basically,
that's what we should do.
Basically,
just have a fleet of
26,000 B-17s.
Please, just forget the rail service.
Bagsy the ball turret. It's an awful lot of money. What a crewman costs to train.
Yep.
You know.
50 men on the ground to get 10 in the air.
Yeah. I mean, this is extremely expensive, isn't it? And yet it's paying off.
Yep.
And it's basically become a juggernaut, isn't it? So
Completely.
Yeah.
So final trip to Berlin that month is on the 22nd of March. But, you know, bad weather is still hounding it. It is March, after all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, in bad winters in the war.
Yeah.
And so... You know, they're not kind of hammering the enemy in the way that they want to, despite these numbers. Having said that, you know, if you've got 1,000 bombers over, and even if only 800 get to the target or 600 get to the target, it's still a hell of a lot of an ordnance being dropped.
Yeah.
And they still do manage to fly 23 days in March out of 30, you know, which
is absolutely incredible.
You know, of which some of those are obviously crossbow targets. But even so, that's quite a lot. But the interesting thing is now, at the end of March, the formal role of the... of the CBO, the Combined Bomber Offensive, ends. And this is the point that you were talking about earlier on. The Strategic Air Forces now get handed over to the Strategic Overall Forces, which is Eisenhower and Scheiff.
Yeah.
You know, because on the 1st of April, Eisenhower takes over direct control of the Strategic Air Forces.
Yeah.
So this is Spots, this is Harris. He's now got control over where those air forces go, and incidentally also the tactical air forces. Yeah.
And effectively is the most powerful man on Earth at that point.
Yeah, yeah, he is.
Because of the forces he has at his disposal.
Completely.
Right, so join us after the break. We'll look at the crews, and then we'll look at what Overlord has in store for the bomber offensive.
Yep.
Hold up. Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with our 8th Air Force series. Is this episode?
Episode 6, Summer 44.
Summer 44.
Although so, we started in the spring.
Yes. Well, the last raids we talked about were the raids.
Maybe we should just call it Overlord this week.
I think it is called Overlord. Because it's your tyranny of Overlord stuff here.
Yep.
And obviously that last raid was on the 22nd of March, so we're past the equinox now. So the days are getting longer.
Yep.
In theory, the weather's improving, but it's still massively changeable, which is because that's the normal weather, as we pointed out a few episodes ago. That's the normal weather in Europe. It's American weather that's unusual with its clear skies.
Yes, exactly.
So let's look at the cruise. We started this episode with Bert Stiles.
I thought it'd be interesting to look at him because he's... You know, he does write this brilliant book. And if anyone hasn't read Red Serenade to the Big Bird, I just literally couldn't recommend it more highly. It's such a fantastic book. It is in print just about... as a sort of crappy kind of print-on-demand kind of version you can get on Amazon.
Yeah.
But it is just fantastic. It's absolutely beautifully written. And he's just a very interesting figure all round because he comes from Denver, Colorado. He's a son of an electrician and a music teacher. He's obviously really, really bright. And he's also ambitious. And his ambitions are to write.
Yeah.
Goes to Colorado College and he writes for the campus newspaper, which is known as the Tiger. He's quite political. He's pacifist. He's that sort of classic kind of bookish, good-looking young man who's kind of wants to change the world, slightly idealistic, all those sort of things. He writes a number of short stories in 1941 and sends them off to various literary agents in New York and gets a nibble of interest from the husband and wife agents, Ruth and Max Ailey. And so he hitchhikes to New York, and they hire him as a hand on their farm in Connecticut.
Right.
And say, look, come and work on a hand. We'll give you board and lodging and we'll give you some, the benefits of our literary wisdom.
Right.
And he goes, it's a deal. So he goes there and gets his first story published in Saturday Evening Post and writes for various, like Atlantic Magazine and various others. But obviously it's wartime and, you know, he's a young man, he's come of age. And he enlists rather than waiting for his draft. So even though he's a pacifist,
he's idealistic enough to go and...
Yes, because he feels very, very strongly that Hitler and Nazism is a wrong that needs to be
stamped
on. And also, you know, you might be a pacifist at 18, but you kind of, you know, change your mind a bit.
Yeah.
So he wins his wings, flying B-70s, and gets sent to England as a replacement pilot in March 1944. And there he joins the 401st Bomb Squadron, which is part of the 91st Bomb Group. One of the smaller bomb groups.
Yeah.
Not 100.
Yeah. Yes.
Bassington. And he's a second pilot, not a first pilot. And this, I've never really got to the bottom of how you get chosen as a first pilot or second pilot. I guess it's just your kind of report on your wings and stuff like that. And if you're kind of, you know, if you're excellent,
how do the RAF do it?
We only have one, don't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have pilot and flight engineer. They're saving on people.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have two pilots.
Yeah.
So, but weirdly, he's second pilot to Lieutenant Sam Newton, who he had been friends with at Colorado College. Just by total fluke.
That's fortunate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're old friends, and they're on a B-17 called Times A-Wastin'. They do a practice mission on the 18th of April, and then the first mission on the 19th of April, which is to Castle, which is, you know, decent.
Yes.
A decent stretch. That's beyond the dams.
Yes, it's the other side of the dams, isn't it? Yeah.
And, you know, he's doing a lot of missions to France at this stage because this is point-blank stuff. So they're hitting marshalling yards in Rouen and Reims and, you know, a few in the Ruhr and this kind of stuff. And it's interesting reading the book because you suddenly see where kind of... I remember there's a line where the navigator says to the bombardier, who's played by... Who's that guy who's also in Titanic?
Oh, the villain in Titanic.
Yeah, the villain in Titanic, but he's a good guy. He's a kind of sort of medical student in Memphis Belle. And he goes, are you scared? He goes, no, I'm Val.
Yeah.
And Bert Stiles says to Sam on his first mission, you know, are you scared? He goes, no, I'm Sam.
Yeah.
So it's kind of lifted. Um, But on the 7th of May, they go to Berlin.
Right.
So they go back to Berlin on the 7th of May. So they are still doing, even though they're supposed to be doing just purely kind of supporting of Overlord stuff.
Well, we did say earlier on that a lot of this is subject to interpretation. And
well, yes, because of the Heinkel factory at Oranienburg, you can kind of, you know, a ball-bearing...
Yeah. Well, and you're taking on the gaff.
Literally every mission is a point-blank mission.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things about Stiles' memoirs, it's written contemporaneously, it's written in... Most of it is, he's obviously making notes in between the missions and jotting stuff down. And then he compiles the book. It's quite a slight book. It's not a big book. He writes it in July and August 1944.
Yeah.
After he's ended his first tour, before he starts his second one. And there's, you know, it's really good about life on the base, the relationships with people getting on each other's nerves.
Right.
Him and Sam actually kind of rub each other up the wrong way.
Right. Even though they're old pals.
He finds his kind of, you know, Sam Newton has a kind of sort of sang-froid and kind of diffidence that he finds quite impenetrable.
Right.
And he finds it quite frustrating.
Yeah.
Sort of times in London where he's sort of trying to get girls and gets a bit lonely and, you know, so there's a lot of, this is absolutely horrendous. What on earth is going on? And why has the world gone so mad? There's quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
But he's also incredibly vivid about the violence. He doesn't shirk it at all. And I think we should do this bit because it is really, you know, I don't think anyone should be in any doubt about just how brutal it could be. We've done a lot of sort of planes disappearing in flames and all the rest of it. But it's worth kind of spelling it out a bit sometimes, I think.
Well, the thing is the violence aside, being in those planes is an incredibly hostile environment, isn't it?
It really, really is.
The whole thing's dangerous in itself. You know, if you accidentally unplug your oxygen, you're a goner. You know, it's so cold that if you take your gloves off, your flesh will come off on the guns or the instruments when you touch them. Everything about the environment is hostile, even before you get to... The fact well, you
yes,
know.
And it's worth spelling out that if you're a waste gunner, there's a massive hole in the side of the plane.
Yeah, with the weather
and you're at 20,000 feet.
Yeah.
And you know they have these electric warmed suits which are always short circuiting.
Yeah,
and always giving them electric shocks or not working down the leg, but boiling on the chest.
Well, it's easy to break the circuit cable. You know, if you're too strenuous in it, you might break and end up with no heat in your legs. You might not be plugged in. I mean, there's tail gunners, aren't there, who are discovered dead because their oxygen's come out and they're frozen to death.
Oh, yeah, asphyxiated.
All that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a really, really hostile environment. And you've got men with terrible ear problems from flying at altitude and coming back down.
Just going deaf because of the noise.
Deaf because of the noise. All these sort of the physical strictures of being flying at altitude.
I think the thing about these bombers, and you know, if anyone's ever lucky enough to sort of step inside a B-17 or a Lancaster, the overwhelming sensation you have is on the ground they look huge.
Yeah.
When you're in them, they look tiny.
Yes.
They're incredibly cramped. They are tin cans. They
The fragility is shocking.
And what you've got this situation where technology has advanced exponentially over the previous 20 years so that you can create something as sophisticated as a flying fortress. But what they're designed to do is get you to a certain target and drop a bomb as accurate as technology will allow for the period. But they haven't caught up with man's ability to actually man these things effectively.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And they're just not very effectively manned. Yeah. What isn't in doubt is the skill of the pilots, the skills of the crews, they're just... barefaced courage of these guys getting up into a plane every single time that they're going on a mission. But what they haven't worked out is, you know,
the environment.
These are not pressurized cabins. That's on the way with the B-29, but it isn't at this point. It's absolutely brutal. And they're pushing what a young man can do to the absolute
edge. To the complete limit, yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it, that the pressurized cockpit, when it comes, means that you know you can fly in shirt sleeves and all this sort of thing, and everything's rosy. But before that, and it is this idea, isn't it? The bomber can fly high and fast to get away from the fighter, and the crew are the spam in the can. No one's giving it any proper thought.
Yeah, and just try getting into a tail gun.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nightmare because obviously the
ball
tail tapers
is even worse.
It's awful. It's absolutely awful. I mean, I haven't tried that, but I have sat in the tail gunner's position, and you've got to get over yet another spar. You've got to it obviously tapers, so it's incredibly narrow.
Yeah.
It's so cramped. It's not true.
Yeah.
You feel so vulnerable. There's nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
Ah, it's unbelievably
grim. No, it's horrendous, isn't it? But that's before we factor in the violence. So the, yes.
So this one incident that Stiles writes about is actually he's not on flying roster that day. And basically, the crews tend to do is, if they weren't flying, when the raids return, they all come out and watch and count who's in and who's out and all the rest of it. And I know one badly bashed about fort comes in. Actually, it's not that badly bashed about, but there's trouble, and he and the crew get off very kind of dazed. And Stiles happens to be there and goes to offer his help. And if anyone's a bit squeamish, I'd just switch off for the next 3 minutes. So the waist gunner's been killed, and basically, the top of his head from the top of his nose has just been completely ripped off.
Yeah,
and Stiles goes, part of his brain sprayed around as far forward as the door into the radio room. The rest of them spilled out when the body crumpled. And a second bit of flak from the same burst. So basically this burst of flak has just gone vroom, like that. But he's got body armour.
Yeah.
So the body bit of him is okay. The top of his head isn't and his legs aren't. And they've just been ripped off.
Yeah.
And not a single other person in the ship is hurt.
Not even the waist gunner next to him.
He's just taken the full blast of this bit. So there's a massive chunks of torn aluminium out the side of the plane, and this guy's just had the misfortune to take it kind of face on, really, literally. So Stiles clambers in to help the medic, so the crew don't have to. They don't have to kind of deal with the trauma. It's bad enough seeing him there, but don't want to have to sort of get him off. And as he pulls up, his hand goes straight onto a glob of brains, and he takes one look at the body and then clambers out again. And for a while afterwards, he just sits on the grass, not feeling horrified, but feeling a kind of profound sense of shock.
Yeah.
And he writes, all the forts got back. Nobody else was hurt. One man ran through his luck and got it. I didn't know the guy. The face with nothing above the nose was too horrible to remember. The body could have come from anywhere. Seattle or Wichita or the Valley of the Three Forks of the Wolf. And so he sits there and looks up at this beautifully peaceful English summer sky. The sun is out. It's gorgeous, a spring in the air or whatever. Well, summer by this point. The wind sort of soft on the grass. And he writes, one man gone, a million more to go. Maybe even a billion before this is over. Maybe everyone in the world will get it this time. There are shells enough to go around. If some efficiency expert could just figure out a way, there would never have to be another war. We could wipe out the human race this time. The senselessness of it and the ugliness of it drove away all other thought for a time. When the despair went away, leaving only doubt and a deep sadness. In a steady, endless procession, wars have swept the world, eaten away at its heart, growing from stupid little brawls with clubs and rocks to the mechanical perfection of a city flattened out in the night. So many bombs to the acre, so many planes for the job. Fill up the bomb bays and send them over. Send in the ground troops to bayonet the ones who are only stunned.
Bloody hell.
Yes. It's quite hard-hitting stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, like all of these people's experience, it's not kind of gloom and despair the whole of the time. There's plenty of larks and black humour and funny moments as well. But you know, here's an intelligent, thoughtful, well-read young man trying to analyse the total bonkersness of clambering into this metal tin and flying at altitude in freezing conditions into scenes of unspeakable violence to drop bombs
through clouds on God knows what.
I mean, you know, when you put it like that, it also seems a little crazy.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I think it's worth just mentioning at this point that the 25 mission.
Well, yes.
That comes to an end. And that there was never kind of any hard and fast rule about this. This was just each theatre has its own different rules, which of course is a catch-22.
Which is the purest catch-22 thing. It's meant to originally kind of be a year, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then it's settled on 25. Then no one's making 25, or a handful of people make 25 missions, and then they put it up.
Well, they put it up in the spring because they're starting to do these crossbow things, which are kind of hopping and skipping these little milk runs in between. But that's a combat mission.
I mean, if you're a crewman, you're like, I've done my 25. I don't care if they're only over the channel.
Well, it's what I'm not sure is whether they're kind of, you know, you get to 24 and then they up it, or whether kind of if you start on 25, you finish on 25. I haven't got to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so 1st of April, it's increased to 30 missions. On the 6th of June, D-Day, it gets increased again to 35 missions.
And that's just because
But losses are going down.
But losses are going down. But it's also
you're more likely to get 335 divisions than you are 25.
But that's to do with that's a tempo thing that you just you can't be laying off crews at this point. Experienced crews.
Well, and also because they're flying so often as well, and it's summer, so you can fly more in summer.
Yeah. So it's a sheer tempo to go with Overlord. So Overlord, the prelude to Overlord at the sort of at the top level is endless arguments about who's in charge of what,
who's in charge and what they
and what their scope is and what they should be and what they're doing and all that sort of stuff. So we're back to the old sort of arm wrestling with Harrison Spots
and Tedder now out of the
God.
I mean, don't forget, Spots and Tedder are mates.
Yeah.
So this is purely professional debate rather than. I hate you guts, you
bloody limey. And there are boffins involved. So Solly Zuckerman.
Yes, indeed.
Who is a British anatomist, zoologist and anatomist, who at the start of the war sort of gets drawn into the question of what does bombing do? How are people killed? What do weapons do to people? And who looks at cadavers from France. He looks at people injured and killed in the Blitz in London. He sets up a place in Stewartby near Bedford, in a brickworks in Stewartby, Bedford, where basically he's blowing up rabbits and birds and stuff because the anatomy of birds is telling him an awful lot about. It's telling him an awful lot about what shockwaves from bombs do, what tiny particles do. The people, he has a team of doctors and zoologists with him. But he starts number crunching and he starts thinking. It comes away basically from the fatality thing because in the end he says you can't draw any conclusions. It's all too impossible to actually say what kills people. But what we have to do is use air power, and he's a real believer in air power over land power. He's a complete convert from looking at the Blitz, which I think.
Well,
really
he's also behind the bombing of Pantelleria.
Well, this is the point. So
Spots and him are really, really tight.
Yeah, he goes to North Africa and he gets involved in what you can do with air power, and his brains are picked by all sorts of people,
not least Spots.
Yeah, exactly. So Pantelleria is this offensive using only air power in the Mediterranean, which is actually effective. And then he then talks about how what you need to do is attack bridges and attack basically transport nodal points in Italy. Harris calls him the so-called expert. Harris cannot stand him.
No.
But what you've got is this the idea of this transportation plan, that what you do is strike at German transport. You strike marshalling yards, you strike at basically Germany's ability to move people around. And do you do that close to the potential battlefield or do you do that further back? And that's the transportation plan argument, and its argument with itself.
Which is incredibly sensible because there's two things here. First of all, most of their fuel is synthetic fuel, which is made using coal.
Yeah.
And coal moves from A to B by rail. So if you can stop that, then you can't make any synthetic fuel. You don't need to hit the synthetic fuel base because you've
gummed it up.
But the other thing is, of course, that the whole, the glue of the Wehrmacht is the Reichsbahn. And if you can dismantle that, it's like an Airfix model where all the glue has suddenly kind of fallen to pieces and the whole thing just collapses.
You know,
it won't work. So there's good sense of it. But at the same time, Spots is
arguing. So this is the point, is that there's other opinion too.
Yeah.
And that's oil. So Spots' oil plan.
Yes, and you know, he's got some scientists as well, not least Zuckerman, who he's still really, really tight with.
Yeah.
And he reckons that he can by targeting all these oil plants, whether it be Ploesti or whether it be these synthetic fuel plants in every refinery that the Germans have, you can account for 80% of production and 60% of refining capacity. And that's the end of them. Yeah. And that's fine, but the flaw in that one is that's all going to take time. That's not something where you can have immediate results. You know, you hit a bridge and the bridge goes down, you've hit it.
Yeah.
And you can do that by next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a much more kind of sort of esoteric target,
I suppose. Well, I mean, it's back to ball bearings. Where can we find, what is the thing that, where we can, you know, what's the German funny bone and how do we best hit it?
But the interesting thing about this is actually that historians have made big play about these debates over the transportation plan and the oil plan. The reality is that actually they run concurrently and they can run concurrently. And the so-called argument between Tedder and Spots is not really one at all.
Yeah.
It's about emphasis.
Yeah.
And actually, the solution is one that Spots is pretty happy with.
Yeah.
So it's a completely false argument. And the idea that you can only have one target type of target is absolutely nonsense, because...
Well, if you've got 1,000 bombers to put
in the sky...
We
already know that they're not doing that.
Yeah, you already... Yeah. I think a sort of centre of... If you're constructing the story that it's all everyone all disagreeing with each other, you could always resort to Harris to have some memo where he scribbled in the margin, says who, yep. or, yeah, not bloody likely or whatever. And there you go, Harris. Yep. You can go back to Harris and say he disagrees. But Harris actually, if he's ordered to do something, does it. So actually, he's not that big a sort of fly in this.
No, he's not really. And they do spot it. I mean, the point is that Harris keeps saying the most efficient use of bombers is to just area bomb.
Yeah.
But his bomber force then keeps continually, as 1944 progresses, disproving this theory by becoming incredibly accurate, and not the 617 Squadron, the Dambusters, who by this point are becoming, you know, under Leonard Cheshire, are becoming precision bombers par excellence. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're supremely good at it, and their way of doing it is sending in mozzies at very low level, very fast,
marking
targets very accurately, and then everyone goes
and
in.
Eventually Mustangs. So eventually Mustangs.
So.
There's a bombing policy conference on the 25th of March.
That's right.
And the notable thing is that Eisenhower's chairing that.
And so, he's absolutely had it up to here with all the discussions and twos and fros and kind of Harris, Potts, Tedder, you know, everyone having their two penny for Arnold picking in.
Yeah.
And actually, he says, if you don't do this, I might actually resign. I can't be dealing with it. He has an off-record resignation threat.
Fantastic.
Sometimes you just have to pull that particular card. And obviously it works.
Yeah. Well, and also, again, we're back to these people who they have the luxury of being able to argue about this, don't they? They're not under, in a strange way, they're not under the sort of pressure. If you're the Luftwaffe, you're thinking, Jesus, how do we deal with all these threats coming at all at once? The fact is that the bomber force is now so powerful, you can pick and choose, you can decide. You know, in that sense, it is now a truly strategic weapon, isn't it? In a way that it wasn't the year before.
Yep.
It really has the possibility of strategic intervention in a way that, I mean, you think of Schweinfurt-Regensburg, which is what? Not even six months ago. Schweinfurt 2 is not even 6 months ago. Sheer transformation.
It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what absolutely comes clear out of all these debates in March 1944 about the form that the strategic campaign should have in the run-up to Overlord is a lot of it is to do with Lee Mallory, my favourite person, who is, for those who can't remember, was 12 Group Commander in Chief during the Battle of Britain.
Mm.
Later got bumped up to be 11 Group Commander, which was Parkside one in Southeast England, and then later took over command of Fighter Command itself.
Mm.
And he never went to the Mediterranean. He was never hanging out with you know where all the kind of real action was at, with all the kind of top notch. Airmen that were developing in the Mediterranean, you know, the Quesada, Doolittle, Brereton, all these guys, and Cunningham, and so on. So he's out of that loop. He's not considered to be a team player. He's quite sort of, he can be quite truculent, but he can also be...
Fail to develop a strategy as well.
He's just sort of, you know, a bit sort of personality bypass.
Yeah.
And the problem is that because he's been in situ in 1943 in the UK, he is put in charge of all the air forces for the invasion. And the concern by Spots, and frankly, pretty much everybody, is that Lee Mallory will be the guy in charge. In the same way that Monty is in charge of is Commander-in-Chief of the ground forces, Ramsay is in charge of the naval forces, Lee Mallory is in charge of the air forces, and Spots just doesn't want this guy,
who's
completely talentless, to be in charge. And that's what this is really about. And... I mean, what's interesting with Lee Mallory is he just gets more and more sidelined as I mean, Conyngham can't bear him and basically kind of kicks him to one side.
Yeah.
And they just do their own thing. And one of the things that's kind of sorted out in the 25th of March conference is that transportation plan is going to take the priority. But the oil plan will come in when the opportunity arises.
Yeah.
And increasingly so.
Yeah.
And so...
I mean, Spots
is happy with that.
But again, it's one of those faintly vague bombing directives that leaves everyone wiggle room.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is you couldn't be too prescriptive because, as you said a moment ago, you can't have one target. You're 1,000 bomber force and how you're doing things is by sending some of it one place, some of it another place. You've got to come up with the targets, haven't you?
Yeah. On the 19th of April, Eisenhower gives greater priority to crossbow because they can see that this is being accelerated.
Yeah.
They're about to do the invasion. What they don't want to be doing is these new... wonder weapons, secret weapons, kind of being directed towards the invasion fleet.
Which, as it happens, doesn't happen.
But it might do.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You don't know that in April.
Take that extremely seriously, yeah.
So these sites are repeatedly pummeled.
Yeah. And all this time, Bomber Command are showing that actually they can bomb accurately. And Harris is sort of... I suppose it is a lack of faith in his... in what his crews can do is, you know, they're hitting marshalling yards, they're doing what they have to do in terms of transportation plan. And it's incredibly effective. I mean, it's the thing that means in the end, because a big part of German decision-making is where do you place your armour in the event of an invasion? And if the railway transportation is being hammered, that reduces your options.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to bet on Pas-de-Calais or Normandy or the Eastern Front. The bet you make is a harder bet to make because you're not going to be able to change your mind.
Yeah. The other thing that's really worth pointing out is that the strategic air forces are not doing the transportation plan in isolation.
Yeah.
You know, there is also the 9th Air Force, which is a tactical air force. So that is the sister air force of the 8th.
Yeah.
Commanded by Pete Quesada, who's just totally brilliant, absolute legend. And they're full of medium bombers. So these are twin-engine bombers, which operate much lower levels, much more accurately. These are the guys that are kind of smashing your bridges over the Seine.
Yeah.
Whereas the strategic bombers are going hitting big marshalling yards at Ham or Dusseldorf or Rouen or Reims or wherever it might be.
Yeah.
And you've got the 2nd Tactical Air Force as well, which is the RAF Duke forces
Tons of Typhoons and...
Tons of Typhoons. So Typhoons, which are part of 2nd TAF, 2nd Tactical Air Force under Cunningham, they destroy 78 out of 92 radar stations along the Atlantic coast in France.
Bloody hell. I mean, France is copying it at this stage.
It's copying it big time. And now you've got the situation where, you know, the Germans are finally starting to crumble about this. And it's really important that one doesn't just think it's the 8th Air Force going over every single day.
Yeah.
So the 8th Air Force is now doing kind of much deeper penetrations and also these crossbow targets. But 9th Air Force is also doing crossbow targets and bridges on the Loire and Seine and all the rest of it. And the Germans are just being swamped. And the general in charge of all fighter forces, which is Adolf Galland, who, even though he's only 32 at this point, on the 21st of April, he warns Milch. Goering that his fighters are being completely swamped by the vast number of Allied fighters. This is like Malta in April 1942 in reverse.
Yeah.
And Allied fighters by this point haven't just gained superiority, but supremacy.
Yes.
Do you want to do the Galland
accent? Oh, why not? Well, why not?
I think this opportunity to show up in German.
Well, I think I ought to, really, oughtn't I? Galland, obviously, he is 32, but he's quite clearly an able suck-up, isn't he? I mean, you don't get this job by just talent, do you? You're good at going hunting with Goering and kissing,
slapping thighs
and saying, yes, that pink uniform looks brilliant or whatever.
Yeah.
The ratio in which we fight today is about 1-7. The standard of the Americans is extraordinarily high. During each enemy raid, we lose about 50 fighters. Things have gone so fast that the danger of a collapse of our arm exists.
There you go.
Yeah. So that's a
wake-up call.
I mean, it's thousands of sorties a day, basically, they're facing, isn't it?
Because if 8th Air Force alone could put out 1,000 fighters, then you add on 2nd TAF, then you add on, you know, you've got 1,500, 1,600 fighter planes swarming over Northwest Europe every single day. That's a huge, huge number.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, the radar stations have all been destroyed, so you don't know where they are. So vectoring people with them is much more difficult.
And one of the reasons why these airfields are going back is because part of that Doolittle directive in January 1944 is that when you've done your raid, you then go down and headshot and you shoot up any fighter planes, fighter bases you can.
Attack targets of opportunity. Yeah,
exactly that.
Yeah.
And in fact, actually, as the pre-invasion air plan continues, they then launch little mini operations within the bigger operations. Yeah. And on the 22nd of May, 9th Air Force and 2nd TAF and 8th Fighter Command launched Chattanooga Choo Choo, which some wag has codenamed. And this is a coordinated blitz on the Reichsbahn.
Yeah.
So what they say is, right, chaps, when you go over to Europe, and every time you see a railway line, shoot it up.
Yeah.
Every time you see a locomotive, shoot it up. Just shoot up absolutely everything. And it's an absolute hammering. And one of the guys that I've followed over the years is Gabby Gabreski, who's a kind of sort of first generation. His parents were immigrants from Poland, came over, lived in Coal City, I remember, right. Pennsylvania.
God.
they were miners, obviously.
Yeah.
Anyway, he joins the Air Force. And interestingly, he nearly gets washed out in training. He just can't land.
Right.
He's really, really bad at landing.
Yes, that's a key component.
And he gets his kind of, sort of, right, this is your final chance, and makes it. He's in Hawaii on when Pearl Harbor happens, and goes over and joins the gets a transfer to the RCAF.
Yeah,
flies in the Eagle Squadrons, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
By this point, he's one of the leading aces in the 8th Fighter Command, and he's one of the squadron commanders, 61st Fighter Squadron in Zemke's Wolf Pack.
Yeah.
You know, the 56th Fighter Group, still with Thunderbolts, by the way. And they're on the 22nd of May, first of all, before they do Chattanooga Choo Choo, they're escorting 300 heavies to bombers to attack Kiel.
Yep.
Do that. And then they do a thing which is called Zemke's Fan. So on the way back, they work out that one squadron, the 61st, will go and do one area.
Yeah.
62nd will go and do another area, and they'll just sweep everything for any kind of. And the 63rd will do another.
I mean, just you know, how are you German and not know you've lost?
Yeah. So you basically, these guys are just marauding.
Yeah.
And they're doing the 61st are doing the kind of Bremen area on the way back.
Yeah.
And Gabreski spots a badly camouflaged fighter airfield, and as they approach, they see the Focke-Wulfs down below, thinking, oh, yikes.
Yeah. Scramble.
Again, this is a reverse of 1940.
Yeah.
Luftwaffe marauding over Army of the Air airfields in France, for example.
But with the numbers to do it.
With the numbers to do it and the firepower. So 16 Focke-Wulfs frantically take off, and basically they just shoot the whole lot down. They shoot down 13 of them.
God.
Just bam, one after the other. Vantage of speed, height, experience, skill.
Yeah.
50 caliber machine guns.
Yeah.
And you know, that day they also kind of destroy six locomotives, 7 damaged, 18 river barges.
Yeah.
And the really key moment where they know that they've done what they need to do in time for D-Day comes on Sunday the 28th of May. And this is a massive moment, because on that day, 858 Air Force bombers hit oil targets. And this is, again, just proving the point that it's not just transportation targets near Magdeburg and Luna in East Germany. So this is, Magdeburg is about 50 miles, 40 miles west of Berlin. 697 fighters are dispatched to on this day. And it's a really big moment, because for the loss of 9 8 Fighter Command aircraft, they shoot down and damage 78 enemy planes. And what they've realised is that every aircraft shot up on the ground in that last week leading up to the 28th, so from Chattanooga Choo Choo onwards, has been at least 500 miles from Normandy.
Blimey.
And that is the big moment. So basically, it's absolutely the relentless fighting them in the air and on the ground. It's the marauding on the ground. Yeah. So suddenly these airfields are no longer safe.
Yeah.
And because the radar, as you say, because the radar stations have been knocked out, they're being bounced.
So between January and June, German aircraft losses on all fronts are 137% of established strength. 6,259 lost in combat.
Yep.
3,608 lost in accidents.
I know, it's amazing.
Due to bad weather.
Bad weather and ill training.
They fight despite... And here's an interesting thing. One of the things about the Battle of Britain that often gets talked about is the home advantage that's a force multiplier for the RAF. The pilot's shot down, bails out, he's in a hurricane for breakfast the following morning.
Yeah.
The Germans are not able to pull that advantage in. And even though most of the fighting is going on over Germany, they lose 2,262 pilots in that time.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it? In June, their losses are 3,534 aircraft, which is... Just in June, which is 100 less, basically, or 90 less than the 3,626 aircraft they produce. So even though...
They're treading water.
I mean, that's incredible. Under the strain that German industry is under, they still manage to produce, you know, 3,500 fighters. But the problem is they're losing that many as well. So they can't even tread... They basically can't tread water.
Right.
And that combination of aircraft attrition and manpower attrition means they're done.
If you Goose go back to the kind of early episodes in this series, and you think about that incredible jeopardy there was for the whole of Overlord, this urgency to clear the skies, and how in the balance it was, and the crisis of morale in the autumn of 1943, the kind of where the hell are we going to get enough long-range fighters from? The kind of the slaughter of Schweinfurt and Schweinfurt too.
Yeah.
And all the problems that they had and the angst they're having, even in January 1944, when Spots is turning to Doolittle, going, if you haven't got the guts to the job, I'll find someone who has, all this kind of stuff. By the 28th of May, they've pulled it off.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that there's so many episodes in the Second World War where in the narrative, you know, we just take it for granted. It's taken for granted that the invasion force will get across and that the minesweepers will sweep the minefields out to sea before they land.
Yeah.
It's taken for granted that air power comes in and kicks ass and, you know, they're all going to land on Omaha Beach and Golden Sword and Juno and Utah and all the rest of it, absolutely, you know, without any issue. And the air battle for in the 6 months, you know, in the kind of year before D-Day is launched, is so full of twists and turns and peaks and troughs, the you know, proverbial roller coaster. It's absolutely incredible. And I always find it just amazing that they pulled it off by the 28th of May, 1944, which, after all, is just a week before D-Day.
A week before D-Day, But the Germans are sort of, they're kind of fighting the Battle of Britain in reverse. But against,
not very well.
But not very well. But against an air force that knows what it's doing, has a plan, has the resources at its disposal to pull it off.
Yeah.
You know, the conclusions that the Luftwaffe draw is that we need to be more aggressive. You know, it's all the usual Nazi stuff. If only if we were more aggressive, we'd
just attack.
We would win. If we just attack, we'll win.
If we just if we've just got the will to do it'll happen.
Yeah. And they're putting sort of big wings together and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So they're making this. They're making some similar mistakes. I mean, one of the most amazing statistics is in 1944, 9,000 German aircraft lost in transit. Not even going to battle, lost in transit to Allied aircraft action.
There you are.
That's
dominant they are.
How dominant they are.
And it's absolutely the case that if you were a German civilian and you were living in the western half of Germany, literally every day, you would not just see bombers, you would see fighter planes burning over. And that would, in a way, that gives you more of a sense of your defeat than the streams of bombers.
Well,
because the fighter planes, you can see them, they're low, they're kind of hedge hopping, they're sticking two fingers up at you.
Well, think of the nervous shock of German air power in 1940, in May 1940, that it had on British and French soldiers. Mm. You've got that every single day over the Reich, not over an army, over a civilian population. I mean, again, I come back to what I said a moment ago. How do you not know you've lost? How is a government able to keep this thing going? Well, the writing is plainly on the wall at this point. Anyway, I think we've one more episode. There's a little thing for the listener. We have a clock telling us how long we've got, how long we've kept going, and we've overshot already.
There's definitely bonus content on this series.
Yeah, definitely.
Because normally we think, 40 minutes? We usually do 50.
Yeah.
We've been topping an hour every time, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, because it's
so interesting.
It's an incredible story. So interesting. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll be back with from D-Day to VE Day.
Yep.
The last 8th Air Force sortie is on the 25th of April.
25th of April, 1945.
So we'll try and get to there in our next episode. 45. We'll see you soon. Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.